Good afternoon. I'm going to call to order in the Commerce Committee, March 10th, 2020. We do have a quorum, and we have an order of business to move the approval of the minutes from March 4th. Do I have a motion?
So moved.
Representative Stevenson moves the approval of minutes from Wednesday, March 4th, 2020. Is there any discussion of that motion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. A roadmap for this today and this evening. We have been doing what we can to avoid overtime in this committee because all committees are doing some serious overtime. We will be coming back this evening to finish our member discussion and vote on my bill, 3032. The rest of the day, we plan to get through the rest of the agenda before we come back. We will recess to the call of the chair, which will be approximately till 6 o'clock, and then we will come back and finish that final bill. My intention would be to have a vote by 7 o'clock, so that people have a roadmap of their evenings. With that, we have Representative Sundin ready to present his bill. So I will move House File 4206 be re-referred to the Labor Committee. I hear that's a really good committee.
Fine committee.
I see that there are no amendments, so Representative Sundin, you may proceed with your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and it is a fine committee. House File 4206 is a sum of the work of the Workman's Comp Advisory Committee, and there's several components to the bill. I understand we're going to be addressing the issues in the bill that affect commerce only today. So with me, I have John Kelly. He's a legislative liaison for the Commerce Department, and he will run through the sections of the bill that should be addressed by this committee.
Welcome to the committee. You can state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is John Kelly. I'm the legislative liaison for the Department of Commerce. The commerce-related portions of the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council bill pertain to workers' compensation self-insurance. We have worked out these provisions with industry prior to its incorporation in the WCAC bill. The changes in the bill cap the present value discount to a risk-free rate tied to a rate published by the IRS, prohibit self-insured groups from maintaining a negative surplus, removes conflicting language from 176.181 that says employers are not required to supply certified financial statements, and makes a clarification for the length of time for license for third-party administrators. So the commerce-related portions, section one of the bill prohibits a negative surplus for self-insured employers. Then section two on page three, from lines 315 to 319, that is the cap on the present value discount for the risk-free rate. When the 4% was put into law, that was seen as pretty conservative, but in low interest rate environment, we found that it's actually not anymore. So we've tied it to this IRS rate, 12-month average, and that right now is around 2.5%. Section three, the change there is on page five. This is not allowing a present value discount for self-insured employers who have left the self-insured market. And then the change on page six is a continuation of that. Section four on page seven, we're striking this superseding language on line 7.10 to 7.11. This could be interpreted to allow for a negative surplus for commercial self-insured groups. And then you'll notice that the language that are in the earlier sections around the cap are there again. That is because we're doing it for both regular self-insured employers and commercial self-insured groups. So it's the same language. And then we skip ahead to page 13. This and that So that's section 10, and actually the change is on page 14, my apologies. And we're just striking that two-year period because the governing statute it says 3 years, and we don't want to have that conflicting piece in statute. And that change was actually suggested by a member of the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council. And the last piece is on the last page of the bill is the repealer. It repeals chapter 176.181 sub 6. And that is, there's conflicting language that says employers shall not be required to provide financial statements certified by an independent accountant. That is directly in conflict with what is required in 79A.03. They're required to have audited financial statements. So we wanted to get that out of any kind of conflict. And that is the commerce-related provisions of the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council bill. Madam Chair and all members, I'll stand for questions if there are any.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Is there anybody from the public who wishes to be heard for or against this bill? Seeing no one, we will move to member discussion. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier, you made the comment having a negative surplus.
Yes.
Is that a term, Madam Chair, is that a term of art, or
that
does that actually mean something?
Just one moment.
Yeah. Thank you,
Mr. Kelly.
Madam Chair, Representative Davids, so the negative surplus is a term of art. We want to make sure that groups are maintaining a positive fund balance. So this could be interpreted to allow them to operate at a deficit. That's what that means.
Representative
Thanks,
Davids.
Madam
Chair. Further member discussion? Seeing no other questions, I will. Any final words, Representative Sundin?
Thank you, Chair Halverson. I thank the testifier for explaining the bill. And I would be here tonight if the legislature actually paid overtime to its employees. That would be us, but it doesn't, so you're on your own tonight. Thank you.
With that, I will renew my motion that House File 4206 be re-referred to the Labor Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Representative Grunhagen's House File 3500 is next on our agenda. I am going to move your bill, Representative Grunhagen. I'm going to move that House File 3500 be re-referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members,
proceed.
For hearing this bill. What this bill does, and by the way, you notice it has bipartisan authors, it allows a life insurance policy to be converted to a long-term care policy. It's permissive. It's not a mandate. And so it's an opportunity to put something in statute so that we can allow these to be sold in the future. Now, right now in the state of Minnesota, there are life insurance policies that have a long-term care benefit. This would allow an actual life insurance policy to be converted to a long-term care policy. I just make a couple more comments. If we look at the projection of long-term care costs, the graph goes almost straight up. So in terms of the cost of long-term care going forward, it's going to be dramatic and expensive for the state of Minnesota. I think the more tools that we can put in place for people to provide some of the to provide for themselves to take care of their costs for long-term care, the better we are. This and I think this is a step in that direction. So with that, Madam Chair, I do not have any other testifiers, but I am open to questions and answers.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Is there anybody else from the public who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no one, your presentation must have been excellent. I have a list.
You're
on the list, sir. We can move to member questions. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Grunhagen, I actually have one of these life insurance policies that you can, what the long-term care rider, so that if I became terminally ill, I could draw from my death benefit to pay for my long-term care. So I think this is a really good idea. So thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Representative Davids.
Well, thank you. I agree with Representative Elkins in that this is a great idea, and I thank Representative Grunhagen for bringing this forward. But a couple questions. In the bill, is there anything that would not allow accelerated benefits? Because basically in this universe, you're talking about terminal illness, critical illness, chronic illness. All three have different definitions. But does this bill do anything that would jeopardize accelerated benefits?
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, Madam Chair, Representative Davis. I was informed just as I walked in here that there could be a possibility of that, and I am going to work with those individuals to negate that if that's in the bill.
Okay.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, we want to get long-term care as best we can to become partnership eligible. What does this bill do in that regard?
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Davids, there would need to be federal legislation to allow that. So it doesn't cure it by itself, but it does put it in place that if the feds would move, that we would be able to take advantage of that.
Representative
Davids. Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, again, I think this is a wonderful idea. There are products out there in the market right now, but anything we can do to, and there are term products that have all three benefits available, but anything we can do to encourage us and people to purchase these, you really are protecting your estate by leaps and bounds for the money that you're putting in. So I think it's a great idea, and if we could somehow convert a term or a cash value policy to long-term care, let's get her done. So thank you, Representative Grunhagen, for this bill.
Yeah, and Madam Chair,
Representative Grunhagen.
I just want to assure yourself and the committee members that if this in any way endangers accelerated benefit policies, I will pull the bill. But I think I will be able to get that addressed with a technical amendment. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Davids actually asked my question, so.
Thank you, Representative Kreisha and Representative Davids. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Although policies similar to this have been available in Minnesota, I think it's worth underscoring in the Commerce Committee that an individual who would buy a policy like this would be able to buy it when they're younger, healthier, and cover more aspects of their life as well as their long-term care needs. If I could use the term a policy for life, and Representative Grunhagen, you and your compadres who have brought this forward should be commended. There's only one problem with the bill, and that is it does not have a provision to increase the tax credits for long-term care in the state of Minnesota. We will work on that with the Tax Committee at some point in the future. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll.
Madam Chair, I don't think I've ever had this many compliments on a bill since I've been here.
Representative Grunhagen, don't press your luck.
Let's see if we can get one more for you, Representative Grunhagen. Representative Davids.
Well, I'm going to stop complimenting Representative Grunhagen, but I would, in all sincerity, really like to thank the Commerce Department itself for being a leader in the country on this issue. This is a big deal, mm-hmm. and it's not going to get better. It's going to get worse unless we step up and do things like Representative Grunhagen is proposing here. But our Commerce Department on this issue,
knew there was a but.
has been amazing to work with. They're tough, but they have some products that have been approved out on the market that are really helping people today.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Seeing no further member questions or comments, Representative Grunhagen, you get the final word.
We're gonna do it tonight.
I think everything's been said. I appreciate the consideration, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. With that, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 3500 be referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and you're on your way.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, Representative Stevenson with House File 3099. Welcome to the committee, Representative Stevenson. You can move your bill.
Madam Chair, I'd move House File 3099 be re-referred to the Judiciary and Civil Law Committee.
Very good. And do you have amendments?
I do have an author's amendment, and excellent. I would move that amendment. It is the A3.
And it looks like it's being handed out currently.
No, actually, I think the amendment's being handed out is Representative Tabke's amendment, which I...
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Excellent. Okay, so we do have the A3 in our packets. Sorry, members. So Representative Stevenson moves the A3 amendment. Is there any discussion to that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the bill is in the shape that you want. Do you want to entertain further amendments now, or do you want to explain your bill, Representative?
Why don't I explain my bill first,
okay.
Madam Chair?
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Minnesotans are experiencing an unprecedented deluge of obnoxious and fraudulent robocalls. According to a private firm tracking robocalls, Minnesotans received 500 million robocalls in 2019 alone. That works out to over 125 calls per adult living in Minnesota. What makes these calls particularly pernicious is the so-called spoofing technology, which allows telephone calls originating from across the world to show up as a local number on your caller ID. These calls aren't just obnoxious. For senior citizens and other vulnerable populations, they are a significant source of fraud. In fact, the chief of police in Eagan reported in the fall that he expected telephone fraud to result in over $500,000 in losses just in Eagan, just in 2019. Fraudsters will use spoofing technology to make it seem like the call is coming from a bank or a utility company like Xcel Energy. Then they'll say they're going to turn off your power unless you pay, and of course you'll need to hand over your Social Security number in order to verify your account. And make no mistake about it, it isn't just senior citizens, it isn't just vulnerable populations that are targeted and that end up falling for these types of frauds. I actually had an interesting conversation during the interim with a sitting judge who told me that she had received a phone call purporting to be from the IRS in which the caller said that if she didn't pay, an arrest warrant would issue in her name. Now, bear in mind that this person was a judge who signs arrest warrants, knows what it takes to get someone arrested. And the judge said that she, even though she knew the call was fraudulent, was intimidated by the call. If a sitting judge feels intimidated by these calls, you can imagine how an everyday person would feel getting that call. This explosion of fraudulent robocalls demands a strong response, which is why I proposed this bill, which is the nation's toughest anti-robocall legislation. The bill takes an everything and the kitchen sink approach to solving the problem. To begin with, it expands Minnesota's ban on robocalls and makes spoofed calls illegal in Minnesota. It also requires telecommunications companies to implement the latest and greatest anti-robocall technology at no additional cost to the consumer. Here's the thing. The technology already exists to allow telecommunications companies to block spoof calls before they ever reach your phone. We just have to make sure that that technology is working to benefit every single Minnesotan. The bill also gives tools to the Attorney General and consumers themselves to take action when they receive these now illegal calls. And finally, the bill includes criminal enhancements that will make identity theft or theft by swindle a felony whenever it's accomplished by a spoof call or a robocall. Minnesotans are ready for this robocall madness to stop, as indeed are people across the country. And in fact, the federal government did recently enact a law called the TRACED Act attempting to target robocalls. And I think you'll hear in a little bit some testifiers telling you that we should just allow the federal law to work, or if the federal law goes far enough. I have to respectfully disagree. This bill goes further than the federal law in material ways. Number one, it isn't tied to a specific form of technology meant to counterbalance robocalls. I think that's really important. The federal law is. Secondly, the federal law has an 18-month rollout period before anything goes into effect. I think with the ever-shifting, number one, I think Minnesotans are ready for action now. And number two, with the ever-shifting landscape of robocalls, pegging yourself to a specific technology but then not putting something into effect for 18 months is a recipe for disaster. Lastly, even if you are convinced that the federal law is the way to go and that they got the job done correctly, it is often the case that we enshrine state law protections that are also in effect in the federal law so that our state consumer protection units, like the Attorney General's office, can be partners with the federal government in combating a really pernicious problem. So it doesn't obviate the need for state action simply because the federal government took action. And so with that, Madam Chair, I know there are a number of testifiers, including several that are with me here today, and I think I don't have a list in front of me.
I have a list in front of me, sir.
thank
you. And we will take public testimony and then move to member questions. First on the list is Skip Humphrey. And we haven't, I don't think we sent out that there was a specific time limit for testimony, but, you know, we have a number of people on the list and want to be sure that there's time for member discussion, so ask everybody to be to the point, and I know you know how to do that. Welcome to the committee, and you may state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. And members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to speak. I will try and keep this Humphrey remarks short. My name is Hubert Humphrey, and I'm a resident of Golden Valley in Hennepin County. I'm also a member of AARP, and I am here on behalf of AARP Minnesota. I've had the privilege of serving this great state, of course, as Attorney General, and I've also served as the Assistant Director for the Office of Financial Protection for Older Americans in Washington, D.C. at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, where I led the efforts to combat senior frauds and scams. And I'm here today to testify on behalf of AARP, where I serve as an executive board member. And fighting fraud and scams has been the top priority for AARP, of course, through our Fraud Watch network program. We are in strong support of this legislation, House File 3099. The bill will provide, of course, seniors and Minnesotans with much stronger protections for illegal robocalls and strengthens federal legislation in several important ways, as the representative author has mentioned. Now, unfortunately, you have heard some of these stories, and I suspect every one of you have had the experience of a robocall or two. The robocall technology has made it much easier and cheaper for con artists to reach millions with their fraud schemes. And the problem is only getting worse. Now, according to the FCC, in 2018, the number of illegal robocalls coming into the United States was nearly 48 billion and climbing. 74% of the fraud reports filed in 2019 with the agency, that the FCC, were telephone scams totaling over $493 million in losses. In the recent AARP National Survey, half of the people we surveyed said they received seven or more robocalls per week. In my own experience, I wish it was only seven calls a week. But even more disturbing is that 1 in 10% of U.S. adults have been victimized by a phone scam in their lifetime, and yet few are taking action to protect themselves. In my own experience, several months ago, I was receiving so many spam calls on my own landline that I canceled the landline, never really even picked it up. My wife and I at the time made sure that no one was to pick it up unless we knew the person that was calling, and as you've heard, there's opportunity for that to even be changed. So scammers use readily available software to spoof call ID, making your phone show the number that they want, as was mentioned. Many of the schemes are known as imposter scams, and the telephone message will say that it's coming from the IRS or Security Administration. As the author has mentioned, I have to tell you that I got one of those wonderful calls. I listened carefully, and then I spoke individually, and I said, well, I'd just like to have your name, and I need the number because I'd like to refer you to the Office of Attorney General in Minnesota. The response I got was, click. And so, you know, it happens to everyone, whether it's a judge or whether it's an individual, and particularly to seniors. And it's something that is terribly important that we stop so that we can actually begin to use the technology that is out there. Pressure tactics are common. Can you imagine a telephone message telling you that you must make an immediate payment to avoid arrest? Now, unfortunately, too many seniors have received this kind of call. I also have received that kind of a call. Sadly, our survey found that scams that use threats are more effective with victims than those that promise rewards. And it seems that the scammers have discovered that fear sells. So Under this legislation, of course, the telecom service providers are required to block false or misleading call identification information, and the bill includes associated criminal penalties and violations. Now, additionally, the bill strengthens federal legislation in several important ways, as you have already heard, adding state-level penalties and state-level reporting requirements. And it also prohibits the state from entering into a contract with a telephone service provider that is determined to be in non-compliance with the rules. And it also ensures that Minnesota subscribers are automatically have automatic access to the call blocking technology. Under federal law, the carriers are required only to offer the consumers an opt-in in order to use the more advanced tools to stop robocalls. Now, we are concerned that many consumers may not use the federal opt-in provision, as this requires an additional step that might be taken. AARP is committed to combating illegal robocalls and scams, the scams that they promote, but we need more tools, and this proposed legislation provides exactly that. We urge you to pass this legislation so that fewer Minnesotans will receive illegal calls and fewer will fall victim to fraud. My colleague Jay Hapala is here and has an interesting story that I think you would be very interested in hearing. But thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Humphrey. Mr. Hapala, you may introduce yourself to the committee and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jay Hapala. I'm Associate State Director of Community Engagement with AARP Minnesota, and I lead AARP's Fraud Watch Network, where our fraud fighter volunteers and I meet with people across the state, and we teach them about the latest scams and learn how they're being targeted right now. The situation constantly changes since the scammers use current events to gain their victims' confidence, and right now we're tracking scams that invoke fear of coronavirus and the volatile stock market. Our fraud fighters reach thousands of Minnesotans and empower them to protect themselves and their families, but our work only goes so far with those who are vulnerable and isolated, and every day there are new victims. Today, I'm here to share the experience with you of one of our volunteers, so not just one of our members or community members, but one of our trained volunteers. She did not want to be seen or identified as a phone scam victim. She's an 86-year-old military veteran, a retired physician, and she lives in Mendota Heights. On January 14th of this year, she received a phone call from a scammer who said he worked for Amazon. He said her account had been charged for a $400 gift card. When she said she didn't make that purchase, he offered to help her receive a refund and fix her computer so that they would prevent future charges. She followed his instructions, gave him remote access to her computer, and she completed a form that she was asked to complete. He then returned the form to her with phony evidence she made a mistake that caused him to refund $40,000 into her bank account, not the $400. Because he had remote access to her computer and her account, he was also able to transfer $40,000 of her dollars from her savings account into her checking, so it looked like the money was there. She followed his instructions to return that $39,600 difference. She went to her bank and was assisted by bank staff in making that transfer. It was the next day on January 15th. She called me, unsure if she had been scammed. We determined that she was and began the long process not to catch the scammers, not to get her money back, but instead to stop her from losing more money to the same scam. She had to change her financial and online accounts, made reports to various agencies, and paid for her computer to be serviced. The police told her not to expect to get any money back, and her bank gave her a refund of $800, and the rest is gone. This has been devastating for her beyond the financial loss, which is significant, emotional and mental well-being, independence, family relationships, physical health, and more. She thought she was doing the right things to protect herself, but these criminals are expert social engineers who convince their victims of anything in order to steal their money. The way it is now, there's almost nothing to stop these criminals from using readily available technology to victimize Minnesotans from anywhere in the world. And House File 3099 will prevent future crimes like this from happening, and it cuts off the connection from the scammers and their victims.
Thank you for sharing that story. Please share our condolences with your volunteer, and certainly I think strongly it's not her fault, and I'm sorry that she feels badly that it happened to her, but she was a victim of a crime, so thanks for sharing the story. Next up is Ron Elwood. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. I know your time is short. I'll be very quick. As former AG Humphrey said, everyone is a victim of these, has been victimized by these spoofing robocalls. And just for the record, it is not accurate that I owe the IRS any money. I just want to say that Legal Aid's low-income and senior clients are especially vulnerable to these scams perpetrated by the spoofers. And our clients and all Minnesota consumers can be helped by the strong state action the state could take under this legislation to prevent these scurrilous practices. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Next on the list is Catherine Kelly. And just as Ms. Kelly comes down, I'll let you know that the next in order of appearance will be Anna Boroff and Cam Witten. So everybody knows where we are on the list. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Catherine Kelly, Assistant Attorney General of the Attorney General's Office. Mm-hmm. I am here today to let you know.
Ms. Kelly, if you could just speak into the mic a little bit more. You can even move it up toward you a little bit more, and that way we can all be sure to hear you and catch you on the tape.
Thank you.
No, go ahead.
So I'm here to let you know about what impact the pandemic of robocalls and spoofing has on our office. So much like the tales of woe that you've heard, that we've all heard from our family members, we hear that as well at the office. Every single week, we receive a call from somebody who has lost thousands of dollars, lost their life savings to what usually typically originates as a spoofed robocall. And to be clear, spoofing is, having a name pop up on a caller ID, and for a certain segment of the population, that automatically initiates a response. Oh, I need to take that. It's already illegitimate. So they're already at the level of trust. And for a lot of our population, that then escalates into losses that are catastrophic and devastating. And as many people have testified, that money cannot be retrieved back from scammers who are overseas. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions that the members may have.
Thank you, Ms. Kelly. If you can stick around while we hear the rest of the testimony, and then we'll have member questions. Appreciate you being here. Next up, Anna Boroff, followed by Cam Witten, and then Paul Wirtz. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Anna Boroff, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Cable Communications Association, and MCCA members deliver our voice or phone services via VoIP or voice over internet protocol services. MCCA members share your goal of getting rid of unwanted and robocalls for our customers. We block hundreds of millions of unwanted calls each month. The good news is for you and your constituents that last December, Congress passed bipartisan legislation taking aim at illegal robocalls and spoofed calls often used by scammers. Under the new law called the TRACED Act, voice providers will be required to use authentication technology at no cost to their customers to ensure that the number appearing on your caller ID is the number actually calling you. In short, with this technology, a call using a spoofed number would be identified and then have an appropriate display like suspected spam or something displayed at the endpoint. While many voice service providers have already implemented effective robocall blocking technologies, deadlines in the new federal law will ensure that this technology is implemented everywhere soon. This technology will be reviewed every 3 years by the FCC to ensure it's still effective and make any changes necessary. This is just one of the new requirements in the new law. The federal bill took comprehensive action requiring the FCC to undertake over 24 regulatory proceedings and other agency actions covering a broad range of robocalls issues. It includes firm statutory deadlines. It ensures stakeholders at all levels are fully engaged. The FCC was also given the ability to deter violators with larger fines and a longer statute of limitations. Lastly, and importantly, it enlists the help of state AGs to increase federal and state enforcement of laws applicable to robocalls violators. Congress took the right approach. It recognized the risk of blocking calls that should not be blocked, like emergency calls, while still eliminating the annoying and often fraudulent calls that no one wants to receive. State legislation would interfere with the good solution Congress has enacted. While the bill is well-intentioned, the bill creates vague and conflicting requirements that are problematic when mixed with the aggressive efforts companies in the FCC are making to implement federal law. We should give this new law a chance to work before contemplating additional steps. Minnesota cable companies remain committed to shutting down the illegal and unwanted robocalls that our customers detest, and we are dedicated to protecting the safety of our subscribers. Thank you for the committee's time.
Thank you, Ms. Boroff. Next up, Cam Witten, followed by Paul Wirtz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Cam Winton. I'm testifying on behalf of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance. And MTA opposes this bill, and we ask you to vote no. Boy, do we hate spoofed robocalls. We all hate spoofed robocalls. If the thing before you today were a vote on whether or not we hate spoofed robocalls, we should all vote yes, we hate spoofed robocalls. But that's not what's before you today. What's before you today is a particular set of legislative requirements, new powers for state government, and fuzzy new standards that will make it more difficult for Minnesota's telecom providers to do our part to stop spoofed robocalls. You've heard it before, but I want to say it again because it's really important. The federal government, in a bipartisan way, is on the case here. The TRACED Act. Let me read off what the acronym is for. The Telephone Robocall Abuse Criminal Enforcement and Deterrence Act, the TRACED Act, passed with almost unanimous support in both the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House. Every single member of Minnesota's congressional delegation in both the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House voted in support of the TRACED Act, which was late last year. The TRACED Act, instructed the FCC to move ahead with enforcing various protocols. Key among them is something called STIR SHAKEN. Let me read off that acronym. And as I pull it up, I'll tell you, boy, I tried to memorize it, but I didn't succeed. And now, embarrassingly, I don't have it right in front of me. But STIR SHAKEN is a long one that gets at authentication protocols. It's a set of protocols so that the computer systems will match up or try to match up what the call says it is with what the call really is. If it's a call, for example, there's quite a bit of spoof robocalls that come from Eastern Europe. Nothing against Eastern Europe, but that's just a fact. So if it's a call from your relative in Eastern Europe and it says it's from Eastern Europe, okay, it's probably not a spoofed robocall. If that call says to the computer that it's from St. Cloud, but it's actually from Eastern Europe, that's a red flag. And you may have noticed already on your iPhones and other caller ID technology that you'll have a little note pop up that says potential spam. That's an example of the type of technology that the FCC is requiring telecom providers to put out there right now. The final piece, and I could go on for much longer than I have, Madam Chair, regarding the requirements of the TRACED Act, STIR SHAKEN protocols, but there are also beefed up penalties under the TCPA, the Telephone Consumer Protection Act. And I want to emphasize again that this is bipartisan and it's current. So layered on top of that is this new proposal to create particular legislative powers and requirements in Minnesota. And I thank Representative Stevenson. He's been a joy to work with, and I said to him, maybe someday we'll find a bill we can work on together, because boy, I enjoy working with the gentleman. But with great respect, there are a number of parts that miss the mark. Even if this bill were necessary, which it's not, because of all of the robust action happening at the federal level, this bill misses the mark. Let me just rattle off a few pieces. And before I do, let me just drive home who it is in Minnesota that would bear the burden of these provisions that miss the mark. I don't need to tell you about your own districts, but I can picture, and I've been in many of your districts, and I've been all across the state. And in most towns in Minnesota, right there on the main street, there's a hometown telecom provider. It's probably been there since 1935. It might be in the fourth generation of family ownership. And it's that telecom provider that always has a float in the 4th of July parade, that always is providing scholarships to the local high school for kids to go off and pursue their career, that's a true pillar of the community. It is that company, and 70 of them, plus bigger companies, comprise the Minnesota Telecom Alliance. It is that company that would bear the brunt of these fuzzy new standards in Minnesota law that would be enacted by this legislation. So, Madam Chair, in my closing moments, let me just point out a few of them if I could. 2.24 to 2.32 in the original bill is what sets out the standards. And in the DE that's been presented today, some words have changed. But it would require that telecom provider in Main Street, Minnesota, to prove to the Office of Attorney General that it is implementing commercially available technology to identify and block spoofed robocalls. Commercially available to whom? Somewhere in the United States? To them? There's another piece of the DE that talks about undue cost or technological infeasibility. It's 2.1 of the DE, undue financial burden, excuse me. It's unclear whether that's an objective standard or a subjective standard. That Main Street, Minnesota provider has a much different financial situation than the big conglomerate that's providing telecom service. I also point out that in the DE, it takes the power to administer this requirement away from the Public Utilities Commission, and it gives it to the Office of the Attorney General. No disrespect intended to the Office of Attorney General, and it's an honor to testify after a former one, but it's unclear that the Office of the Attorney General has the technological expertise to determine what's technologically feasible, what's financially feasible for Minnesota telecom providers. And finally, Madam Chair, thank you for the time here. On 2.16 of the DE, it lays out felony penalties of up to 5 years in prison. Again, 5 years in prison for displaying incorrect numbers. Now, three lawyers huddled in the corner before the hearing today. I was one of them. There was another who can choose to identify himself if he cares to, and Rep. Stevenson. And three lawyers looked at that provision and came to different conclusions about it. And Rep. Stevenson said that it was not his intention to put 5 years and to put Main Street, Minnesota telecom provider in prison for 5 years for a bad caller ID. But that's not how two other lawyers read it. So I don't doubt Representative Stevenson's motives there, but I just want to make clear that the language in front of you, 2.16 of the DE, gives a lot of concern to Main Street, Minnesota's telecom providers. So in conclusion, we all hate spoofed robocalls. Minnesota's telecom providers are working under the auspices of the brand new, bold federal regulatory scheme to stop them. I appreciate the intention of this bill to keep Minnesotans safe, but it misses the mark, and then we ask you to vote no.
Thank you, Mr. Winton. Next up is Paul Wirtz. And you can correct me on the pronunciation of your name when you introduce yourself, sir. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's Paul Wirtz. I'm the state president for AT&T Minnesota. Let me start by solving the mystery of Shake and Stir. No, it's not a James Bond type acronym. It stands for Signature-Based Handling of Asserted Information Using Tokens, that's the Shaken, and Secure Telephone Identity Revisited, so you get the Shake and Stir. We live in a world of a lot of acronyms in the telecommunications world. I appreciate the opportunity, Madam Chair and committee members, to speak on this very important topic. Let me open by saying that AT&T is absolutely committed to fighting against robocalls. For years, AT&T has been dedicated to combating illegal and unwanted robocalls, and we have taken numerous steps to protect our customers. In 2016, AT&T launched Call Protect and Mobile Security. Both are free services that automatically block fraud calls, label suspected spam and telemarketing calls, and help protect smartphones from potential threats. That Call Protect is now on 40 million of our devices, and by mid-year, it will be at the point of sale of every device we sell, every device in our platform. In fact, all wireless carriers have free apps on their network that curb robocalls. Last year, we expanded the AT&T Call Protect to include new features to make unwanted robocalls even easier to avoid. AT&T has blocked or labeled more than 1.3 billion suspected fraud calls and more than 3.3 billion other suspected calls through the AT&T Call Protect services. As a result, we have blocked almost 6 billion unwanted robocalls on our network. We block nearly 12 million robocalls every weekday on our network. Finally, we lead and collaborate with the industry to stop robocalls. AT&T chaired the 2016 Industry Robocall Task Force. We've played a leading role in the development of Stir, Shake, and protocols, which is caller ID authentication technology designed to let consumers know when a call is being spoofed. We are one of the first providers to implement the protocols. And we work with industry providers to develop and implement the traceback process, which maps the call's path through multiple networks to identify the call originator. Traceback has been an important investigative tool for law enforcement, including the state's attorney generals. We're proud of our efforts to fight robocalls, and we will continue working every day to protect our consumers, to fight discourage for consumers. That being said, we believe House File 3099 is unnecessary because Congress recently took action to provide consumers more protections against unwanted illegal robocalls. The Minnesota congressional delegation entirely voted in favor of the TRACE Act in both chambers of U.S. Congress. I won't go over some of the highlights of the TRACE Act. I know those have been articulated earlier, but it is comprehensive new federal law. And I should point out that just since the law was enacted, we've had two major actions by the FCC. Just 4 days ago, FCC Chair Ajit Pai said that he will open up a notice of proposed rulemaking on March 31st that mandates that the stir-shaken technology be implemented by all providers by June of 2021. And on February 4th, and I think this really illustrates the sense of the robocall fraud and the perpetrators of this fraud is taking place. I don't have copies. We can make these available. The Attorney General and the FCC sent letters to such companies as All Access, Globex, Piratel, if you can believe it, Talkie, Telecat, ThinQ, and Third Base. These were companies that are based in the United States but are allowing overseas companies to authenticate calls that result in these robocall scams. In fact, Social Security fraud was $19 million. But these are overseas companies that are committing this. So the FCC is really going after some of these bad actors in the United States that are allowing these calls to be authenticated. In addition to the work at the federal level, last August, all 50 states, plus the District of Columbia, attorney generals, and 12 voice service providers signed on to the anti-robocall principles and agreed to work together to protect consumers. Under the anti-robocall principles, voice service providers agreed to implement call blocking and caller ID authentication technologies and aid attorneys generals in identifying and investigating the individuals who engage in illegal robocalling. While well-intentioned, we do not believe states like Minnesota should pursue separate legislation that would detract from significant steps already taken by Congress and the state AGs to fight robocalls. We should allow time for the federal law to be implemented and to do its job, along with the work that's already being done with by providers like AT&T to fight illegal robocalls and protect consumers. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else from the public who wishes to be heard for or against this bill? You may come down. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Carrie Sheldon, and I am in. I'm just trying to explain myself. Where, you know, I keep getting robocalls at least once a month, and they're all trying to get my Social Security information, and something's got to be done. Obviously, I've tried selecting the option to get my name on a do not call list, and they still get through. And I don't know how. There's got to be something that can be done about you know, these lists that we should be able to get to. Not have our information shared at all.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Is your name?
Is there anybody? Yes, she did. Is there anybody else from the committee who wishes, or from the public who wishes to be heard? You may come down. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is, and committee, my name is Lonnie Duberstein, and obviously an AARP advocate volunteer, but I'm speaking on behalf of myself and a friend. My friend went through a similar experience to the one that Jay Hapala mentioned earlier today, and while she was on the phone with the scammer and had already let that scammer get into her computer, on her cell phone then, she called me and said, Lonnie, get over here. And I only live 2 miles away, and so I was over there quickly, and he was still on the line. He wanted her to go to the Apple store and buy several Apple gift cards and mail because he had transferred money from her savings account to her checking account and an egregious amount, and said that in order to get that back, you know, you send it back to me. On the way over there, and he wanted her to stay on the line until she got there, and insisted on that. In fact, I got on the line and tried to ask, what company are you from? She thought he was from the company that she had legally purchased to service her computer regularly and clean out stuff, but he did get into her computer, and she literally watched on the screen as her bank account went to zero. And when I got there, she was shaking. If you ever, you know, you've heard of the term basket case. She was a basket case, literally. She didn't know what she was going to do. She saw all of her money drain from the screen in front of her. And I said, and she was ready to go to the Apple store and buy all of these cards and give them to, you know, and mail them to this person. And what I suggested was stop at the bank. Say it was a couple of months ago. It was a snowy day, and it was kind of rush hour. I said, tell them that it's going to take some time because of that. We stopped at the bank on the way. The manager looked into her account. Money had indeed been changed in her bank accounts. And fortunately, nothing had been withdrawn yet. They immediately put a freeze on her accounts, and so everything kind of worked out. We then had to go to Best Buy, as mentioned by the bank manager, to get the computer scrubbed. And while we were there, we told the story to the person as to why we needed the scrubbing of her computer. And he said that, and bless Best Buy, he said that their salespeople are now being told to ask if someone comes in and looks a little bit nervous or is buying quite a few gift cards at one time or a very large gift card, to ask them why they're doing that, so that they have to kind of go through that story and say, yes, this is legit because, or no, I've been scammed. She's an intelligent person, a college grad, and someone that has had a career in education, and yet she was duped by a very forceful, very authoritative sounding person saying, you know, leading her down this path. If the federal government now has this TRACE Act, and why am I still getting, at least a dozen calls a week that I don't know, or it says possible scam or a report? Everybody in this room right now knows people that do not answer their phone unless it has the contact name. Now, I've got 200 or 300 contacts in my iPhone. Unless that contact name comes up, I don't answer the phone. And I'm supposed to answer the phone because I'm a president of a state organization and supposed to answer calls from members around the state. And how many people here already know they don't answer the phone, or their friends don't answer the phone, if they don't have their number in their contact list, unless they leave a message? It's almost like you should leave a message saying, if I don't have your number in my contact list, I'm not going to answer the call. Leave a message. I'll get back to you. Thank you, committee.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else who wishes to speak for or against this bill? Seeing no one, we can move to member discussion. Representative Tabke, I see you have an amendment. Are you offering your amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, I offer the A4 amendment.
Representative Tabke is moving the A4 amendment. Representative Tabke, do you want to explain your amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been working with the bill author on this amendment, which goes along with exactly the issues that we are trying to work on with this spoofing bill. And so it's been very clear that recently the text messaging has really increased in the amount of text messages that people in Minnesota have been getting that are not solicited text messages, and mine have increased significantly over the course of the last 6 months. And so this bill will clarify in statute that text messages mean a transmission that occurs over wireless messaging service, so that it can be added to the robocall section of the statute that we have in place. So it is just clarifying the text messages, that spamming text messages are not allowed in Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Tabke. Discussion to the A4 amendment. Representative Stevenson?
I think it's a great amendment. I urge the committee to adopt it.
Any further discussion to the amendment? Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of the A4 amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Discussion to the bill as amended. Representative Katiza Watun.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Stevenson, I read through the bill. I wasn't familiar with the term spoofing, and occasionally have used Google Voice service where, you know, they do have my personal information, but if somebody were to elect to use that service and get a number that they can call from their phone, but it shows up as a different number and they didn't have like their same information on, they're not a robot. Does this bill doesn't apply to that situation at all?
No, I don't.
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Katiza Watun, I don't think that Google Voice falls within the definition of the spoofing.
Okay. Representative Katiza Watun. Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not really a question, just a quick story that I want to share, kind of get on the record, is I'll go out and meet with our senior homes and getting all the residents there in the room. And in the past, I have brought representatives from the Department of Commerce with to talk about fraud. And their hang-up on fraud program is always a big hit. And the presenters will start by asking the members in attendance, those that have been subject to this, to raise their hand. And every time I've done this, every hand goes up. So, you know, it's more than just numbers and stories from people we don't know. It is real. It's in our communities, and it's happening. And the level of sophistication is constantly changing. The Department of Commerce has the work cut out for them in trying to stay up to speed on all the latest schemes that are out there. I think this bill would do a lot of good for hardworking Minnesotans, so I fully support this bill.
Thank you, Representative Carlson.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm wondering if Mr. Winston would come back. Mr. Chair, and to Mr. Winston, I'm just curious that you had mentioned the five-year penalty, and I was reading through that. Two questions on that come to mind is, can you, in your interpretation and how you read that, can you tell me, A, who that would apply to specifically? And we know that a lot of these calls may be coming from out of state or out of country even, and so how do we trace that back to get the correct person? The second thing is, can you also give me an example of other crimes that have a five-year sentence and how this compares to that?
Sure.
Mr. Winton.
I look down, I look up, we've got a new chair, it's a party switched.
Okay. It's very confusing.
Madam Chair, Representative Kreisha, I do want to answer your question, and let me note that Representative Stevenson had a different interpretation, and so, Madam Chair, you'll run things how you see fit, but let's get all the facts on the table, right? So as I read it, 2.13, let me hit 2.13 and then read on down to 2.16. A person found to have violated section 325E.281. Well, that reference is the new bill. false caller ID information prohibition is 325B281. So a person found to have violated that may be required to pay a fine of not more than $1,000 for each separate violation, except that, now I'm under 2.15. If their prohibited call resulted in ID theft or theft by swindle, then the penalty is up to 5 years, right? So as I read that, it's the prohibited call is the call referred to up in 2.13. There's a violation, which I read to mean it includes a telecom provider. If a telecom provider allows display of incorrect caller ID information, then they are liable for up to 5 years in prison under 2.16. And just briefly, I'll note that Rep. Stevenson noted that embedded in the criminal law, of course, is an intent requirement that is not met here. And of course, he's right, but looking at the four corners of this bill, it doesn't say anything about intent. And so someone down the line could say the legislature was trying to increase penalties, and right here it says nothing about intent, so we don't need to find that the Main Street Minnesota telecom provider had to have intent. They just displayed, it's prohibited, that's the penalty.
Representative Crescia.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and I'd certainly like the bill author to respond as well. But my second question, and then however you want to see fit.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I'm going to have to
Mr. Winton.
You want me to do the phone a friend, or I'll turn to the prosecutor here. I looked at them but didn't memorize them. So.
Madam Chair,
Representative Stevenson.
I can answer that question.
Thank you.
In my day job, I'm a criminal prosecutor. So the answer to your first question, first of all, it's important to understand what the five-year reference is. Mm-hmm. That's a statutory maximum. So under Minnesota law, we have a sentencing guidelines commission that sets out how sentences are calculated. It'd be very rare for anyone, almost impossible for someone to get actually 5 years in prison for the commission of this offense. The 5 years in, is the stat max for a variety of what are called property offenses under Minnesota law. So generally your theft statutes are going to fall under this. Identity theft is going to fall under this. If you go into a store and steal $1,000, that's kind of the what the stat max will be. So that's the answer to that question. I want to speak about criminal liability generally, and with respect to Mr. Winton, who's a friend who I've known a long time, and I respect, I'm sure he's a great lawyer. He's not a criminal lawyer, and he proved it in the committee today, because it's just not possible for someone to be prosecuted under this statute. I'm sorry, we have gone back and forth about this tremendously. You can't, under 60952, you need to prove an intent. For liability under this statute, it is impossible. And if Mr. Winton can find a criminal defense attorney who can show to me that there's criminal liability under this statute, I will amend the bill to reflect it. That I will make that commitment publicly. That's not the intent, nor does the words on the page establish that liability.
I want to, we're moving into a portion of the bill that actually is really not under the purview of this committee. It's under the purview of Representative Lesh's committee, which is where the re-referral is to. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can guarantee you could find a criminal defense attorney who will say anything for the right amount of money. So I don't know why you even said that, but.
I do love you, Representative Lesh.
So with that the motion is to re-refer the bill to Representative Lesh's committee, which I assume you will have a robust conversation about the criminal aspects of this bill. And so I just want members to be aware of that. Representative Crescia, did you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that, and I would just I know this is going to be debated in the next committee. However, I think it's important it will affect telecoms, and they should have that precursor going into the next one. And all I was trying to do was just establish that there will be differing viewpoints on that, and trying to get peace in the valley is very important as we try to move things forward. There's differing interpretations. Your lawyers, I think you're both wrong.
Thank you, Representative Crescia. Representative Stevenson.
I would just say that I have had more meetings with telecommunications companies related to this bill than I can count. The author's amendment that I offered today incorporated a number of clarifications in language to address some of the concerns, and I'm happy to continue that conversation and continue to try and work on the bill.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. And as you know, that is our grand tradition in Commerce, is to make sure that the parties continue to work together. So thank you for bringing that forward, Representative Cresha, and thank you for your commitment to continuing to work on the bill. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of questions here. Throughout the bill, this section is effective following final enactment, and you got the same at the end of the bill to cover the whole bill. Does that mean that if this passes and gets signed by May 18th or June 1st, the telecom communication systems are all on the hook on the day that it goes into an enactment and are subject to those penalties, or is there a period of time for them to get caught up on the technology and get it installed?
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mahoney, there's a period of time. I think if you look to Section 4 of the bill, or did we do it in the amendment? Mr. Eliff's here, if he could maybe help me. We put this in, but I if you could direct
Mr.
me.
Madam Chair, I think Representative Stevenson is looking for lines 1.7 to 1.9 of the amendment, which state that, first of all, there's a safe harbor provision in this bill for telecommunication providers who are determined by the Office of Attorney General to have implemented these call blocking technologies. And what lines 1719 says is, during the interval between the effective date of this act and the first time that the Office of the Attorney General has received information from the providers as evidence that they've implemented this, and when the Office of Attorney General makes a determination, they're within the safe harbor. So until the Office of the Attorney General makes that determination, there's no prohibition or violation.
Okay. Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Stevenson, I'm afraid to ask this question, but briefly, what does your bill do that the feds don't?
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, a number of things. Number one, the bill has an ongoing and continuous requirement to implement the sort of latest and greatest, in layman's terms, in call technology, anti-spoofing technology. The federal law is tied to the stir-shaken technology that we've heard about, and this law goes far beyond that. This law also gives consumers a private right of action against the telecommunications companies to the extent they're not in compliance with the law. That doesn't exist under the federal law. The criminal penalties that we've discussed don't exist in the federal law. I'm probably forgetting a few things, but that's I think those are sufficient differences maybe to distinguish the two laws.
Thank you.
Mahoney. Representative Davids.
I'll pass, Madam Chair.
Any further discussion, members? Representative O'Neill. My apologies, I saw you. Representative
you.
O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a procedural question, since we are talking about 609 criminal penalties, and I realize it's going to go to judiciary civil law because it has civil penalties in it. Will it also be going to public safety, where we deal with the criminal aspects of this, since it still retains some of those criminal aspects?
I'm going to let the author comment because he's been speaking with the chairs.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Neal, I did speak to the committee staff for both committees, and my understanding is that both the Civil Law Judiciary Committee and the Public Safety Committee have kind of overlapping jurisdiction over penalties, and that it was decided that in this particular instance, Civil Law Judiciary would hear both as to the civil penalties and the criminal penalties. So it will not be going to public safety.
Representative Neal.
I think it should go to public safety too, because that's, we talk more about the criminal side, and since you've maintained some of the criminal aspects of this and not converted it all to civil, I think it should go to both committees. I just want to get that on the record. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Any additional comments, questions, acronyms? Seeing none. Any final word, Representative Stevenson?
It's a good bill. Vote for it.
Representative Stevenson renews his motion that House File 3099 be re-referred to the Judiciary and Finance and Civil Law Division. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails. You are on your way. And members, just as an update, members and members of the public, as an update, because of the fine and efficient work of this committee, we are going to continue with our agenda. We will discuss House File 3032 until 4:15. If we want to continue the discussion, we will recess and come back at 6 p.m. I, as the author, am happy to do that if you guys have questions and want to discuss the bill further. But with that, I'm going to turn the gavel over to, do you want to chair? To Representative Howard.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 3032 be re-referred to the General Register. And I can present my bill. We did hear this bill, as you guys recall, last week, and we heard we provided ample time for public testimony. There was so much interest in public testimony that we are doing this hearing in two parts and doing the member discussion now. I will just take a moment and refresh folks' memories, if that's okay, the purpose of this bill is to finally, once and for all, clear the market of fit-flavored tobacco products that have been the pathway to addiction and disease and death for our youth and for communities of color. We know, because of the historic lawsuit that we had from the state of Minnesota with the tobacco companies, that menthol flavors, that flavored tobacco products have been used and used successfully to hook new users on tobacco. It's time for us to close the loophole that's existed for far too long. And we've been asked, and I've been part of these discussions for years, we've been asked to just provide some exceptions, just provide some out. And by doing that, and by quote, being reasonable, what we have done is created a pathway for tobacco companies to target children and to target communities of color. We know that communities of color are using tobacco at much higher rates because of this targeting, and we know that our kids, especially today, are using tobacco at higher rates than they were just 2 years ago. We have made tremendous progress in this state with regard to public health, with regard to ending addiction to nicotine in the state of Minnesota. And so it's time for us to do the right thing and close that back door for our kids and for the health of our communities. Mr. Chair, I'm happy to take any questions.
Representative Sudinski.
Thank you, Madam Mr. Chair. Sorry. So just looking at your list of banned flavors, if it has no flavor, is that considered a flavor?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Chair and Representative Swazinski, that's a great point of differentiation. Tobacco, if you consider some tobacco flavored, then that's not a flavor. So some vaping products have plain tobacco flavor, and that is not considered a flavor like mango or menthol.
Representative Swazinski.
Madam Chair, my question is, let's say it doesn't have a flavor at all. Is that considered, because it's mostly, I'm guessing, is a synthesized flavor, so the tobacco isn't necessarily, it's an added flavor, too. So you'd add something. What if you didn't even add that flavor? Would that be considered a flavored product?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Chair and Representative Swazinski, under this bill, that would not be considered a flavored product, and that would not be the intent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just one other question. So, kind of looking at you talked about your goal of this is to eliminate nicotine. If the product is flavored and doesn't have nicotine, is that blamed or banned in this bill?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Chair and Representative Swazinski, all flavored products are included. any claims of zero nicotine are actually not verified. There is no oversight to the manufacturing of vaping products. And in fact, if you go into a vaping store and you look at the shelves of what the percent of nicotine is, it's typically handwritten. So these are kind of typically mixed up in a back room and not verified in any way by the FDA. So in terms of what is in the products, there is no oversight. In terms of how much nicotine, which is a poison, is in the product, there is no oversight. There are claims to what is in them, but there is no oversight and no way for the consumer to be sure of what's in the products. So we do a total flavor ban.
Representative Swedzinski.
So the goal of this bill is to ban nicotine, even though we don't have a way to test it. But even if things that don't have nicotine, maybe someone just likes to do it, that would also be banned.
Mr. Chair and Representative Swedzinski, you are correct. And it is because there is no way for the consumer to know what they're actually getting. And so if we were to make an exception and say you can have zero nicotine, there is no federal oversight to the product. And so there's no way for the consumer to actually be sure. There's no way for us as the state of Minnesota to know that people who are invested in selling a product that you can get addicted to are not selling products that are tainted with nicotine, even if they claim that they aren't. They're just not the oversight for us to allow that kind of exception in the bill.
Madam Chair, I have a question. We heard a lot of testimony about kind of the compliance checks, et cetera, in a lot of the stores. And I'm just trying to square that with the incredible spike in usage amongst youth. And I just wonder if you'd comment on sort of that piece of it and how this bill gets at that issue.
So compliance with regard to maintaining sales to what was 18 and older, and now it's emerging that it's 21 and older, and we're going to codify that in state law, is a local activity. It's the funds go to the local level, and local governments carry out that enforcement. We did hear a lot of testimony about the commitment that these businesses had to ensuring that nobody under 18 is getting the product, but it is very clear that we continue to have a vaping epidemic, as was described by the Surgeon General, and an epidemic of increase in tobacco use and outrageous addiction among kids. Go on TikTok and see kids talk about vaping. Kids talk about getting what they call nic sick because there's such high levels of nicotine in some of these products that they vape until they puke, basically. I never thought I'd say that in a committee hearing, but nicotine is a toxin. Nicotine is poison. And nicotine is one of the most addictive substances on earth. And so we need to close every possible loophole we can in order to stop the addiction, stop the trends within our youth, and also to stop the targeting of communities of color for death, disease, and addiction to nicotine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't see anyone else on the list. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the bill author. And I know the answers. I'm just kind of bringing it back around. But when we ban flavors for all flavors, that would include the banning of the flavoring of marijuana in vaping products, too. Is that correct?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, the bill does not address cannabis because cannabis is currently not legal in the state of Minnesota. So we're dealing with all the products that are currently legal and defined as a tobacco product in the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Chair.
Representative
O'Driscoll.
Yes, Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you. The reason I bring that up is there is a bill that was introduced last year in the Minnesota House called House File 420. I think it's rather apropos that that bill be called 420. And for those who have visited this topic, know 420 is a code word for marijuana in the general vernacular. Those who would like to vape marijuana flavored, they don't even have to worry because perhaps soon marijuana will be legal in the state of Minnesota. And I find it kind of ironic that four people who sit on this committee have also signed on to that bill who will probably be voting
in favor of taking away vaping, but at the same time support bringing marijuana to legal use. As a matter of fact, it goes so far as to expunge from records of persons who have been convicted of crimes. It seems a little bit intellectually dishonest in that situation. Now, I could be wrong about how people are going to be voting on that, but I have a sneaking suspicion that I might not be too far from the truth on that, Madam Chair. I've said my piece. Thank you.
Chair Halverson, I don't know if you wanted to comment, but I see no further discussion, so we'll give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. And I'm going to go ahead and acknowledge that this is not an easy thing. It's not an easy lift, and it I think challenges us greatly to take action that some people find to be a big deal, and it is a big deal. But the fact is this is the action that we need in order to stop. We have left the door open for so many years, and the tobacco companies continue to figure out how to target our kids and target our communities of color. This is the best and most important thing we can do to prevent the next generation from becoming addicted to tobacco. And as we had a youth testifier here last year, I will tell you, when I was in high school, we were going to be the smoke-free generation. I went to a concert starring the Jets. If that tells you how long ago it was that said that, you know, those of us who were going to be graduating in the 80s were going to be the smoke-free generation. We weren't. And we have lost friends and families to this addiction. And to have children in our communities today being targeted for addiction at this level, it's time for us to take the action we need to take action that we know is going to result in a reduction of nicotine addiction for our youth and a reduction of nicotine addiction in our communities of color. So I thank members for being part of a long and thoughtful hearing, and would urge your support.
Chair Halverson renews her motion to re-refer House File 3032 to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
The motion carries, and you're on your way.
Thank you, members.
And Chair Halverson.
We are going to adjourn, Mr. Chair, but as a housekeeping measure, since we are the last committees to be heard at the end of the day, and we know our staff needs to move on, finish their work for the day, I'm just going to ask, as one of the moms in the room, if everybody could separate their papers and stack them up for the staff so that it doesn't take them so long to clean up the room. That's all.
A great idea. And with that, we are adjourned.